listen. Question. Discover. Understand. And apply. Welcome to Conversations. It is commonplace to hear about Australia in the context of massive fires, drought conditions, and shrinking water supplies. Australians have been dealing with these circumstances more than they'd like, I'm sure. And in the process, they become quite experienced with innovative responses to drought and new points of views in managing water. I have the great privilege of sharing conversation today with Dr. Michael Young, Professor of Economics from the University of Adelaide in Australia. Dr. Young, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
I'm doing pretty well. Now, you're not in Australia, right? You're in Paris now. What's going on in Paris?
Actually, I'm over here working with the OECD. They've asked me to do two things. One is to write a general paper on the state of the art in coping with water shortages, and the second one to write the high-level framework for how actually the Dutch might start thinking about water shortages. They have just started to realise that unless they're careful, they will run out of some water in some areas that could really threaten a lot of the things that they do.
This entire water issue is a topic that's being felt around the world now. I hear it so often, and I see as I listen and watch the news that water's on top of it all the time. Now, Dr. Young, he's a research chair in water and environmental policy at the University of Adelaide. He's also a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia and a distinguished fellow of the Australian Agricultural and Resource Economics Society. You have so many positions, it must keep you mighty busy. Is life calm right now?
It's never calm, but it's always fun and exciting.
Now, this new idea, I would say it's causing you to become the hottest thing since sliced bread. At least that's what they say here in America. How would they phrase that in Australia for a new topic that's a hot deal?
It's almost the same thing. It's, greatest thing since sliced bread, and water management in Australia has really been at the forefront. We had most of last decade in a really severe water shortage. One stage we had all our mainland cities except for Darwin on severe water restrictions. Cities like Brisbane went down to almost running out of water within about the last month of supply. People were very, very worried. Our irrigators were equally worried. Some of our rice growers got no water at all for about 4 or 5 years. The water allocated to them was zero.
Is there a backup plan at all? I mean, even if it would provide just a very small amount of relief?
Well, you can't make it rain, and that's the real problem. And with our water resources, we've come to the conclusion reluctantly that you can only allocate water that exists. And in 2006, for example, in what's called the Southern Connected River Murray system, where most irrigation occurs, the amount of water that flowed into the dams was enough to recover about or to cover half of the evaporative losses. So everybody knew the system was in serious strife. When there isn't enough water to keep the system flowing, then what do? We were lucky. We had some water in dams. We had just enough to keep us going. We ran the dams down too empty. We stopped the bottom of the river. We drained it almost completely dry. In fact, I flew there in a helicopter and landed in the bottom of one of our lakes, which had never been empty before. We were really desperate. But out of this has come a tremendous suite of lessons that are globally applicable about how you set up state-of-the-art water management and allocation regimes that cope with the worst that actually the climate can throw at regions and solve the overallocation and environmental problems in a fairly elegant way.
Are you relying on surface water only, or do you have some aquifers that are quite abundant in water?
We used to largely leave people to just do what they liked with groundwater. We've now discovered that large amounts of groundwater flow into river systems. In fact, they often the groundwater makes up a lot of what's called the base flow. And so now we've gone into a system where we manage the two side by side, both groundwater and surface water. And that proved necessary, is if you don't do that, people who have access to both groundwater and surface water swap from taking surface water, which became expensive and rare and hard to get, started taking the groundwater, but that groundwater used to flow into the river, so it was robbing Peter to pay Paul. So what we've done, Steve, in Australia, is we've moved to what are now called water sharing arrangements, where we share the amount of water that's available. We used to give people absolute rights, much like your priority rights system in the United States. We now just give people shares of what's available, and we're finding that's driving a lot of investment, causing a lot of innovation. It's much more efficient than the sorts of systems that you find in the United States, especially in the western side of the United States.
How do you know how much is really available? That's one of the nebulous aspects of it. Is it sort of in the moment? We go out and we measure off of gauges and we make estimates of what's in the aquifers?
We have to get both the aquifer side right and the surface water systems right. Surface water systems are much easier because we just look to see how much water's in the system. And you can do that by just looking at a dam and then from that working out when to release it. Groundwater, the biggest indicator, and the simplest systems are just off depth to groundwater. If the groundwater table's dropping, you know you're taking out too much water. And with a bit of experience, you can work out how to manage that. And they build models that link back to rainfall gauges and so forth. So it's become quite sophisticated, but the greatest actually describer or indicator of all things is what's happening to the groundwater table. If it's going down, you know you're taking out more than is coming in. If it's going up, you know you can take out a bit more.
Right, and there seems to be a lag time many times with groundwater too. So once it starts going down, we know that it's actually been going down for a while, and so we have to be much more conservative with our water. Now, yeah. As a water economist, you it's sort of a different title. I don't think of water and economists in one grouping here. How did you end up sort of morphing your economics sort of background with water? How did that evolve?
It started off, I did agricultural science, got interested in ecology and the environmental issues, started looking carefully at how governments set up leasing and licensing systems and to deal with scarcity in the early stages in outback Australia, then looking at things like fishing, forestry, and even climate change, and ended up looking at water and have found actually all the arrangements around water to be fascinating. And in the last about 15 years, I've spent nearly all my time looking at how to improve water allocation systems. And I was lucky to be around in Australia at a time when people were looking for new solutions. And so we started talking about what would be really robust, and robustness is an interesting idea in itself. Robust systems work really well when the chips are down and they're really under pressure, when things are going wrong and everything's breaking everywhere. They keep on performing well and really elegantly. Mm-hmm. And we decided to focus on trying to find water allocation arrangements that would work really well under severe drought. And out of that came the idea of defining entitlements, as we call them, as shares, just like shares in a company, mm-hmm. making allocations to people in much the same way that companies make allocations in the form of a dividend, and they credit them to your bank account. And Australian farmers now have access to water accounts where they can look up on the internet and see water as it's made available to them being credited to their account as they actually use it. It's debited from their account. And when you're in a situation, if I wanted to sell some water to you, I can just go to my account and transfer it off my account and onto your account, and there's no difficulty in doing that. It's not rocket science. It's been done before, and it operates all over the world, and that's why it's working so well for water in Australia.
Well, you know, when I had read the book The Big Thirst, and you were a part of some of those interviews in that book that was written by Charles Fishman. He mentioned that, talk about the simplicity of this approach that you're talking about. You made a little drawing on the back of some napkin or some piece of paper of a cup of water, and you divided that cup of water into several different layers. The bottommost layer and most important layer, the priority layer, was the environmental needs, and then with critical human needs above that, and then high security water use, and then general water use. Maybe you could describe how that came about. You know, it seems like you have developed in this sort of simplified approach a priority system of use, of beneficial uses.
Well, what we did, and this is really important, is that in the past we used to have a priority system of uses. And, you know, I've just been in the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands that's what they have. And what they do is when water's short, they switch off the low priority. What we did was say, look, we'll have what are called priority pools or resource pools, volumes of water that are set aside for, as you would understand, the first thing is what we call conveyance water, which is a little bit different to environmental water. So water you need to have in a river before you can take water out of it. So if you're an irrigator and you want water, you first of all have to have a river with enough water in it that you can get your pump to work. That first bit of water is called the conveyance water. It's needed to convey the water to you. Then above that, we have a priority pool of what we call high security water, which is typically used for things like towns and really high value uses. But we just give shares to that high priority water and leave it to the marketplace now to work out whether that high security pool of water is held by a town, by a factory, or by an irrigator. And similarly with the lower classes of priority, we do that. And it's really interesting. A lot of people now say, well, they want to spread their risk, so they'll have some high security water, some general security water, and others don't even hold any entitlements at all. They don't hold shares. They just buy their water as they need it. And some of the most successful irrigators in all of Australia now don't own any water entitlements. They prefer to just go onto the water market and buy water when they need it. It's cheaper.
Wow, and that really is working. That's wonderful. In California, we have a huge issue right now with the California Delta. And I was thinking of your description of environmental water versus, say, conveyance water. In that situation, if we have enough water for conveyance, we still are hurt environmentally by the quality of that water and its temperature. It ends up creating quite a problem with the ecology out there. Is that taken into account with this approach? I mean, I suppose there's some sort of redefining of these terms depending on where it's being applied.
Yes, and what I've been talking about is a fairly general framework. We have another thing which is very important. We have what are called catchment sharing plans, and these are plans that essentially define the priority system I've been talking about, the size of each pool, how much water is going to be given to the environment, and how much is going to be available for users. We put a lot of effort into that and into the rules around that, and that determines how much water each shareholder in the system gets, which is different to your priority systems where you have your senior users who can take the water they need no matter what. We have a system where the calculations are done for things like the Delta, and then what's left over is then shared amongst all the users. We have lots of arguments too about how much is needed for the environment. But one of the other things we've done with these frameworks is we keep the lawyers out of it. We have a framework which says once water is allocated, it's allocated. And if you think something's wrong, you lobby to change the plan and the rules in it. but you can't stop an individual trade from one person to another.
So how
is very different.
How did the attorneys respond to that? They have no say so.
Well, they never really got involved. It's a different thing. The United States has a legal culture where the attorneys play a very big role in almost everything. In Australia, our system is much more like the way a corporation operates. General Motors, for example, wants to stop making a car. The attorneys have no right to go in and order them to keep on making the car. It's a decision taken at board level in accordance with lots of corporate rules and regulations, but once the decision's made, that's it. And so we put a lot of effort into working out which people are on the boards and authorities that make the decisions, the processes that are used to work out the rules of the game, including how to trade, order. But once those rules are worked out, that's it. But that's required us to redefine all of our entire entitlement system. We moved away from the system, the sort of systems you have, to a totally different one. It's been really interesting, Steve, when we went to the new systems we're now using, which we started rolling out in the really around about 1996, 97 through to about 2002, 2003. At first, the irrigators were very opposed to changing what they said were their rights, very worried about it. They now love the changes that have occurred. They've seen a rapid rise in the value of the water entitlements they hold, because we've come up with a framework which people trust and know will work no matter what happens, and that's because it is robust. And they all say we've got to keep on doing this. At times they hate it because it's hard decisions, but they like the wealth that's come from it. They like the fact that now we have a regime, if the environment wants more water, then it has to go and buy it. And we've seen that happening. We have environmental water holders who actually manage water on behalf of the environment and are now talking about ways to become much better environmental managers. We've gone from a regime where you just protect the environment and the environment takes the water that's needed, to a regime where there are incentives for environmental managers to get it right too.
What if people don't want to give up their water? So there's no shares that are up for sale and the environment's hurting. How does that, I'm just, you know, this is a real dilemma here in California. Everybody, for the most part, is seeing through their own needs only. And yeah. It's not a matter, I mean, everyone here looks for guarantees. And the culture in this area is one of, I need to get my water first. You need to hear me. You need to hear me right now. So in the case of the environment, I would and during shortage, I would think that that could be problematic, because no one's going to want to give up their water. And then the environment or a particular farmer in some region would end up experiencing the bad end of the circumstance.
Well, that was the sort of discussion we used to have until we discovered that people were prepared to pay to have access to water. And the really interesting thing is that a lot of people are able to use less water if they're paid enough for it. And people who really need water in a hurry are prepared to pay a lot for it, provided they can get it really quickly. So our trading systems enable people to move water from one water account to another in days. Much like if you wanted to transfer some money to me, Steve, I could give you my bank account details in Australia. You could log into your bank account in the States, and within probably 48 hours, the actual money would be sitting in my account.
You know, that is a huge benefit. I mean, when I've discussed with the Central Valley farmers here in California some of their concerns, one of them was they have to make their decisions in December for what they're growing in the fields in months, months later, many months later. And then when April shows up and they find they don't have enough water, they're totally stuck. There's no mechanism that allows them to find the water that they need to, you know, within reason, to accomplish what they need to accomplish in the fields.
Yeah, and you know, the systems we have are so much more efficient. Imagine a situation where we've got in Australia, when right in the heart of the drought, where the price of water would shift with the weather forecast. If there was rain forecast, then the price of water would go down because people would say, I'm not going to have to irrigate this week, so I've got some water I can sell. So there's a really dynamic market, and people were in there looking at the price of grapes, tomatoes, milk and everything else, and working out what they could make from actually using water, the money they could make, versus, for example, if you're a dairy farmer, you can go and buy grain and feed your cows on grain rather than feeding them grass. And so we've got a really dynamic, fast-moving system where things get sorted out very quickly. And Steve, surprise, surprise, these arrangements work across state borders. You can move water from Victoria to New South Wales to South Australia and back again in 48 hours. And, you know, a lot of farmers, in fact, now have water holdings in each state. And they move water around depending on where it's raining, what's up to their crops, where they're up to. And our environmental managers do the same thing. I sit on the board of an environment trust, and we have water holdings that we have to manage and think about where we will put the water, which bit of environment we're going to look after, how long we'll put it there for. But it's all done around a set of rules and which everybody understands and trusts.
So exactly how does this work now? I noticed in one of the articles that you have written, publications, that you talk about entitlements and then you talk about allocations and then use licenses. How do these work together? What are they and how do they work together?
Okay, well, the whole process is called unbundling. And when you have a water right, as you call it in the United States, it's sometimes described as a bundle of sticks, and part of it is about the time that your right lasts for, which is normally in perpetuity. Part of it is around the amount of water that you're allowed to take and what use you must put it to. You have rules around what are called beneficial use, and then you have site-specific rules around where you can apply the water, when you can release water back into a river, and that sort of detail stuff. What we did is we pulled that sort of system apart. We now have shares for the entitlement, which is your long-term interest.
How are those acquired?
By now going to a water broker or onto an internet-based water trading site, like Waterfind is one of them. And you look at what they're available for, and you buy some if you want it. The share registers are maintained by state government, and their integrity is guaranteed, and you can mortgage those shares if you want to, just like you can mortgage land. Very, very simple system, and that gives you a stake in or a share of whatever water is made available to a pool. Then when you make allocations or make water available, we call them allocations. It's just like you've got so many acre feet of water which can be used in the next 2 months. It's allocated to you, and you can sell those allocations. The rules are you can use the water if it's in your account. You can sell it to somebody else if it's in your account. Or you can decide to leave it stored in the dam for next year. And one of the things we've been fascinated to see is how much or how keen farmers are to save water for next year when it's been really dry. So if the dams are really low, like they are at the moment in actually parts of the United States, and the snowpacks are low, then what's the smart thing to do? The smart thing to do is to save some water for next year. We've seen a lot of people do that.
I suppose there's a rate of decay, so to speak. If you're going to leave water in a dam through a very hot period of time, a lot of that's going to, you know, some of that's going to evaporate. So maybe you had an allocation of of 10, and what may be available next year would be only 8 because some of it evaporated. Is that taken into account?
Yes, that is taken into account in some of our systems. In quite a few, however, though, we just take that off the top because essentially the surface area of our dams, which are really efficient, stays pretty similar, is quite predictable, and trying to work out the difference between evaporation if you had saved the water versus evaporation if you hadn't, it's so the difference is so slight it's not worth setting up the accounting systems to do it. But where there are big differences, then that is accounted for. But there is water that's kept always in storage for everybody, and that's needed for conveyance. That evaporation comes off the top, and so we're talking about marginal differences in evaporation, which is often not a lot, but where it is a lot, yes, we do account for that.
Yeah. This sounds like it's adding a component that we really desperately need here in the Western United States. I mean, the entitlement, it sounds to me like the entitlement is what we have purchased, what we have bought, shares of water. But what you have added here is a reality check on how much wet stuff is actually present. And that would be distributed through the allocation of what actually showed up this year in our rain and snow melt.
Yeah. And so rather than having a system where junior water holders get no water and senior water holders still get their full allocation, everybody gets a percentage, which means that there's a big incentive for the more senior people to find ways to save water as well. We've seen a revolution across the board, and the way you solve the whole transition problem of getting out of, if I can call it, the American system to the Australian system is to just issue more shares. So you go through a conversion process, put the new arrangement in place, and watch what happens. And what we have seen happen is the value of the new water rights jumps up and the value of the old ones stays low. And it doesn't take long for astute actually water right holders to work out that they would be smarter under their new system. And especially their banks and the people they borrow from go and see them and say, we won't even lend you water until you go to the new, or actually lend you money until you go to the new system because it's so much better. Move there in a hurry. So the market takes over. And the other bit, which is really important, is you discover that you can use a lot more water. Because you're running the system with a much finer actually degree of control, we've gone to the system now with support from everybody that requires all water use to be metered. And we have a rule which requires people to comply with that. And water users now all understand that if somebody's taking water that's not allocated to them, they're actually stealing it from somebody else, and everybody has an interest in having compliance with the system because the higher the degree of compliance, the greater the value of all their water entitlements.
How do they treat a situation like that?
If somebody takes more water than they're entitled to, there is a small grace period where they have to go out and buy water on the market to make good. So if you accidentally took too much water, they don't throw the book at you immediately, but you've got to find someone who hasn't used the water and buy it from them very quickly within a short period of time and make good. If you don't make good, you find typically about 3 times the amount of water that, the cost is if you went out in the market and bought it. So, of course, you have rocks in your head to pay the fine rather than go the smarter route, which is to buy water. If you keep on doing it on a regular basis, ultimately you end up in jail.
So it's a very, very serious, really very serious threat.
You've got to be careful there. It depends how you're doing it and whether you're doing it fraudulently or just taking water under a licensing regime you're not entitled to take. If what would probably happen is you would go bankrupt and be declared bankrupt. I think you call that Charter 11 or something, do you? I'm trying to think.
Yeah, Chapter 11. Yeah.
So you go into that and then they shut you down, and that would probably happen first.
So to actually find or recognize that somebody's overindulging in their water, you'd have to have some way of monitoring. How is that done in this sort of thing? I mean, you have some pretty remote areas where water's being used, right? So who's going to be watching?
Well, no, it's pretty easy, Steve. First of all, we have accounts that are much like a bank account, and your bank, I'm sure, from time to time, and all the people listening to this have seen that a bank inform them that they're overdrawn and you'd better do something in a hurry to fix it up. And we all know how that operates and what happens if you don't fix it up. You know it's cheaper to fix it up than if you don't. The bit which is important is that your meters have to be read. And people learn pretty quickly to check to see how much water they're taking out of a river or out of an aquifer, and they're staying within their accounts. The best systems we have now, which we're just trialing in some important parts of Australia, use mobile phone technology. So the actually meters can be read remotely on a regular basis. In fact, every second, if you want to.
Yeah, we do the same here. We do the same here. It's great having that technology. What's the how does a user licenses work into this? We've got entitlements, we've got allocations, and now you also have this user license aspect
that's what we call a use approval, and that's just monitoring or making sure you have a meter. So it's a piece of paper that says that you have permission to take water at this precise location, but it must have a meter so that we know where you are. So you've got to you must have a permit in effect that says you can take water at this location, so that the people doing the meter reading know where to find it. But that's separate to the accounting stuff around allocations, and separate to the share registers. And those permits can be changed on a fairly regular basis and kept up with the state of the art. So they're just the local controls. It's a bit like requiring people in the United States to have a driver's license. And if you're going to actually use a car, you have to be approved to use it. In the same way, if you're an irrigator, you need approval to put a pump in a river or in an aquifer, and have canals and channels and all the things that need to be approved. That's done through the local approval process.
To make things a little more difficult here in America, and I'm sure it probably exists over there too in certain spots, it's not just whether the water is available or not, but also it's during certain times of year we need to have water flowing at a certain rate with a certain salinity and quality. And at other times during that same year, we actually can pull more water out. Is that sort of thing figured in? And would that be sort of these types of conditions that would be a part of this licensing that you're talking about?
No, that's done in our water sharing plans at a much higher level. Mm-hmm. We're very careful to keep the system clean and simple. So that means all the rules around determining when water is released are sorted out in the water sharing plans, and the allocations that are made after those high-level decisions are made. So that's one of the other reasons why we can trade quite quickly, because all of those sort of bigger considerations are made first before an announcement's made. One of the things we've learned too is we make actually announcements about how much more water is going to be made available only on the 1st and 15th of each month. We used to do it all over the place, and we used to consult a lot more, and we ended up with insider trading. And as you'd be aware, governments take a very dim view of insider trading. So we now have a rule that says announcements are made on the 1st and the 15th, or actually on the first working day after the 1st and the 15th of each month. And that's So that's also part of tidying all this up and making sure that everybody is treated equitably, processes are fair, and outcomes are very efficient.
So then between the 1st and the 15th of any particular month, you may have different availability of waters because of these kinds of adjustments, of variables that end up working into the actual physical system.
Oh, yeah, you can speculate as much as you like. And in fact, the water brokers encourage people to try and work out what's going to happen and how much water is going to be announced. And people look at the rainfall and all the things and, you know, try and work it out as best they can. But that's done at their risk. And that's what healthy markets do. But the thing that differentiates the systems that we have versus the systems that you have is that ours enable you to manage water supplies very, very quickly. And if the price of water goes up, when you might suddenly even stop watering your crop and say, gee, if I'm smarter off selling the water than finishing off this crop. Or harvesting it early or whatever. All those things are now part of what we do. And having done this, it's been really interesting to see the high-tech companies come into Australia. And 20 years ago, Australian irrigators used to go to Israel to find out how to water crops and what the latest drip irrigation technology and everything was. Now the Israelis come to Australia and they're just blown away with the things that are happening in Australia in terms of development of smart technology, because in Australia now with these arrangements in place, the rate of change in technology is amazing, just so much faster than anywhere else in the world because the whole thing's incentivized. And we're seeing some really exciting things with even seeing the emergence of these markets, encouraging the transfer of land from father to son and even father to daughter, because the opportunities to make money out of these new high-tech systems are huge, but they need young computer literate people there running these systems. And so the dynamics are shifting all over the place. And so we're getting youth back into our agricultural areas because they have the chance to make things work.
Well, we certainly need more youth in our farming communities up here in the county that I live in, which is Nevada County, California. I think the average age is in the 50s. So we really need more younger people involved, and that's it's happening that way. So innovation really flourishes during times of great need, and that's probably why you guys have been so successful in this. When you're dealing with your water allocations, you mentioned that before in one of your articles that you look at the net, you don't look at the gross amount of water. Now, why have you taking that approach?
It depends where you are. Australia hasn't done that everywhere, but there's a big debate around what are called return flows, and you in America actually do this on a lot of your American systems do it, where there is an amount you're allowed to pump out, which might be 1,000 acre feet, but because of the sort of irrigation system you have, 300 or 400 of that might return back into the river or actually back into an aquifer. So the net amount you use is the amount you take out less the amount you return. And we estimate that as best we can. And under a net system, then the only bit you can sell is the net bit. Because if you were selling the gross amount, then someone who was actually taking a 1,000 acre feet might decide, and returning half of it, so they're really using 500. If you had a gross system, then they might sell the 4,000 through to somebody in a city or a factory which is using it all. And in fact, what they've done is they have sold the 500 they were using, but also sold the 500 which was being returned to the system and used by somebody else. And in the early stages in Australia, we made a lot of mistakes because we didn't account for return flows properly. In fact, we've got one stage further, Steve. We're now bringing forestry into this system. When people plant trees, particularly high up in a catchment, they reduce overland flows. And in some of our systems now, we're requiring people who plant trees to buy up water rights from the people who were using them previously. Mm-hmm. This is all just part of having what we would describe as a robust water allocation system.
We have a situation that has developed out west here in some of the states, like the state of Washington and the state of Montana in particular, where for years there has been an exemption to the use of domestic and like small farm wells. And more recently, people have recognized that there are so many of these exempt wells that they have a cumulative effect on the available water that senior water rights people are count on. And so this has gotten to such a point that they have closed down development in certain counties for certain periods of time because there wasn't enough water, and you have to mitigate your water right. And I think maybe some of the issues are related to this net and gross amount of water to some degree, because it seems like it's not taking into account the water that's actually used. Certainly in a domestic environment, you know, 85% of it goes back in the ground again.
Yeah, well, Steve, what you're talking about is a classic government response where when you get the design of your water allocation and sharing regime wrong, and things start going wrong, then governments just have to shut the whole thing down and say, look, unless we can find a solution to this, we're going to have to shut it down. And they often shut down these important economic opportunities for 10 years or so while people have a long fight. And rather than having a long fight, the smart thing to do is to focus on getting the allocation scheme set up properly in the first place. What I'm doing here with the OECD in France and with people in the Netherlands. Last year I was working on a similar set of actually issues in the United Kingdom for England and Wales. They too are starting to realise that they need to set up water allocation regimes that are designed for the future so we never get, or so that they never get into the suite of problems that you could see in Australia and which you can see in amazingly lots of the United States. If there's a better system, put it in place. Don't muck around.
Yeah, well, I hear you there. It's ending up costing people anywhere from $8,000 to, I don't know what the high end is, $12,000, $18,000, something like that, to mitigate the water right so that they can have their home, you know, with water.
Yeah.
Does that sound like a lot of money to you? I guess we're describing an entitlement, right? In through your particular approach to managing.
Well, I think it's right that people should pay what water's worth, and having mechanisms that reveal the extent of the scarcity is really important. And tying that into house prices and things, however you do it, is important, and there are different ways of doing that. And I'm not aware of the details around that, but you would expect regions that transfer to the sort of systems I'm talking about to have water available to urban people at much less cost than is currently the case, simply because of the benefits that come from designing allocation systems that are robust and send early signals about things like risks associated with climate change, types of land use that are outside the system, just getting the detail right.
As far as the critical human needs aspect of this scenario that we're talking about here, this approach, in America, you take a look at household needs and what happens is there's a lot of indoor water, but then we have a lot of outdoor water that's probably not necessary. We don't have to have a beautiful lawn if we're living in a desert, you know, if we're living in say, Las Vegas. But the way our piping works, the way the structure of society works, we don't have a way of separating those out. So how would you characterize the critical human needs of, you know, that would be allocated at the least expensive rate and exclude outdoor watering? How would that be possible? How do you manage that?
Well, pragmatically, you don't. You just make all water available at the one price, and you leave markets to work out whether or not you have it. We do put a lot of effort into educating communities about water that's needed and water-saving technology, and we use price to drive a lot of those changes. The critical human needs water is recognised in the system as water that will always be made available whenever possible, and that even could include what we call suspension of the water sharing plans we put in place. But that's something that would rarely happen, and when you get into restricting back to just supplying critical human needs, then we do ban watering of gardens and those sorts of things. But that's an emergency measure, and all well-designed water allocation systems do have in their back pocket, if you like, a set of emergency powers that enable the whole arrangements that are in place normally to be suspended while you manage through the real crisis whenever that pops up.
So have you ever had a crisis of that degree happen in
Australia? We have. It happened for several years, in fact. We were running, the entire nation almost on empty, which was very, very worrying and led us to invest in building desalination plants and encouraging recycling of sewage and all those sorts of things as people looked desperately to find ways to stay out of actually water supply jails. So, yes, we've been there. We learnt a lot about the importance of having a water-literate community, and Australians are now water-literate. There was a time in the about 5 or 6 years ago, whenever you went to any house for dinner or anything, people would talk about water all night and what to do about it. Everybody was an amateur water expert. Fascinated by what was going on. But there's been really strong support in Australia to getting the detail right. And yes, our systems might sound a little bit more complicated, but it's a bit like the difference between having an old, really old, very simple car that is a very basic car versus having a Formula One racing car. And Australians prefer to have cars now with water supply system with lots of controls, lots of transparency, and a high degree of sophistication, because that gives them so many more options.
Yeah, they like the big splash, not to use a pun, but anyhow. So the Australian National Water Initiative of 2004, that was really an important initiative that sort of pushed recycling more and conservation and things like that, right? I mean, why 2004? Was that after some very, very significant droughts?
Well, it was early on in the drought. It was when the drought was just starting to look severe. The drought actually went on to 2008, 2009. So that was really only the first, that was about the third year of drought. We had another sort of 4 or 5 years still to go when things got worse. But people were becoming very, very concerned. We had done one other thing, which was we set up a national competition policy back in 1994, which forced us on the road towards trying to use water efficiently. We had a Prime Minister at the time, Paul Keating, who gave an amazing talk to the Australian people, where he said Australia was becoming a banana republic, and we were going, or essentially becoming poorer as a nation, because we weren't taking the hard decisions that are so important around things like management of water, the supply of phone services, electricity, roads, railways. He said, on a global scale, we aren't good enough at doing this. It's time to fix it all up. And that was going to require us to have a recession while we did it. But it's probably one of the greatest political calls that was made. It's meant in the global financial crisis that America's been going through, we've been able to sail through it with hardly any hardship because we went back and got a whole pile of the fundamentals right. That led through in 1994 to a National Water Initiative, which to this day is still considered by most actually policy people working in the water scene a state-of-the-art document about how to manage water in terms of all the things that we've been talking about today, plus arrangements like charging for water and recovering the full cost, making sure that everybody values everything, that the environment's looked after, that you get your water accounting right. One of the interesting things that happened as a result of the National Water Initiative is that we worked out that many of our water accounting procedures weren't fit for this century, and the water hydrologists turned to the accounting profession to find out how to build double entry bookkeeping accounts for water and things like this. And it was a really fertile mixing of understanding about how you keep records in a robust manner and how you adapt it to water. We learned a lot from that process of bringing two different disciplines together.
Do the farmers, I think maybe there's a cultural difference. Do the farmers recognize that some years you just don't have enough water, and so you don't push on any type of guarantees because you know they're not real? We push on guarantees because we want them to be real, even though the reality is that we don't have enough water to go around sometimes.
And people do want guarantees, and that they used to expect them now. Part of what we did was, and I was very much involved in this, is we changed the language around and said you have a share of a pool of water, and the allocations might be zero depending on how much water is available. And that's one of the big changes we've brought around. Yes, the farmers will always say they want security, they want guarantees. And we do have a rules in place that stop us from taking more water for the environment without doing that through a market-based process now. And that's given farmers a lot more confidence, also given towns more confidence about what to do. But these are just all adjustments that get made.
Are the farmers also making adjustments in what they grow in the fields and maybe avoiding orchards where you don't have a dependable supply every year?
Yeah, well, that's very important. In fact, we have quite a few farmers who are almost in the business who describe themselves as irrigators, who are structured so that in many years they don't use much water. In fact, some of them will use none. And those farms look like they're very inefficient, and they are inefficient in a technical sense, but that's good because it means they can stop using water and without going bankrupt. If you have a very sophisticated irrigation system with lots of pumps and drip systems and pipes everywhere and lots of valuable trees around being supported by that system, you have to have water every year coming right through. We have other farmers who run very crude systems, and I often go and give talks to our orange tree growers and our grape growers and say they should thank these people, because in the last drought it was these so-called inefficient people who did the efficient thing on a national level and sold their water to somebody else. And if it hadn't been for that, we would have lost all of the plantations we had.
Well, you know, that really helps in a number of different ways. Where you have not enough water, I don't know how the numbers really work out, but where you don't have enough water to plant all your fields, you decide, you know what, I can still stay afloat financially, which is, you know, a real concern these days.
Yeah.
And So they sell their water. They still financially are secure, but they didn't have the crop that year. Somebody else got the water that is at a higher need, or it just worked out. They were willing to pay more. And then that farmer who ended up not growing that year can come back the next year with a bank account that can support next year's crop.
That's right. And in fact, what happens is, I'll try and keep this simple, but if you were a farmer and you can make, say, $80 from an acre foot of water, so you make $80, if somebody comes along and says, I'm going to pay you $160 for it, you'd have rocks on your head to say, no, I want to make my $80 when someone's offering you $160. You take the $160, and then you say, now, what do I do with this, with A, the time I've got on my hands, and B, with twice as much money? And to our surprise, a lot of farmers have gone around and invested locally. People were very worried about what's called capital flight, was that these people would go off and invest the money elsewhere. That hasn't happened. It's ended up, we've discovered that the money stays in the district, stays in the system, and often funds a lot of investment. You know, these guys are now having been paid a lot of money for the water they haven't used, will turn around and buy a tractor and then change what crop they're growing, and next year they'll be back in a totally different game because it makes sense to change.
Yeah, that flexibility really does seem to be an advantage. They're also, I don't know, I would be a little worried about this scenario. I mean, food and water, I think we all agree on, are connected. If the money is better by selling the water to a non-ag use, then eventually we don't have enough food. And then there's a strife that happens, a period of time, so that the market will change. And then we have, you know, then people change their mind because food gets more, you know, more, there's more need for the food. And then things go back again to putting water into food. But that process would cause havoc in society in general, because there would be an element of time where people were opting to not use their water for food. And it would actually cause a problem for something that is so essential in our lives.
Yes, you're right in one sense, Steve, and that's part of a big international food security debate which is going on in places like the FAO, the United Nations, and amongst a lot of water users. And I'm involved in a World Economic Forum, actually committee, which is looking at this very issue. By 2030, it's expected that half of the world's people will be living in a world where the water resources they depend on are stressed, and will be having to go to the sorts of systems that we're talking about. There's a really challenging cocktail of things on the table. There's rapidly increasing populations. As people become wealthier, they tend to want to consume products that use more water. So you'll you'll move from eating rice to eating beef. As you do that, you need a lot more water. Similarly, you might start drinking a bit more wine. Every bottle of wine requires about 300 bottles of water. And so as people get wealthier, they use more water. Similarly, there's been a big shift towards people starting to use water for fuel, for cars. When you grow ethanol, quite a bit of the ethanol which you find in cars in America is grown under irrigation. And even if it's not, then it puts actually pressure on world food supplies. We're also insisting that the environment gets more water. You put all this together and we've got a fascinating cocktail of demands that you stir with great care. If we stir it wrong, we'll end up in serious strife. The good news is that there's thought to be enough water around in the world to meet all of the needs, and water, the 9 billion people that seem to be on the way. The bad news is that the rate of improvement globally in water use has to be about twice as fast as we've ever achieved in the past. So if you're an American water user, it's time to start thinking about how you might improve systems at twice the rate that you've been improving them in the past. And part of that's around shifting to the sorts of systems that we've been talking about today. They're challenging, but if we don't do that, then the world's going to run out of water, and that's going to be very painful. And trade is part of it. Countries like America at the moment import, and I think actually America exports water at the moment to the rest of the world. And Australia does too, but countries like China at the moment import a lot of water in the products they buy from other parts of the world, and then they sell computers and steel and everything back to places like the United States. So free trade is part of the solution.
Yeah, we have an abundance of water. We're blessed here in America, that's for sure. And because we've had so much water, we have a lot of water overuse. And so we have a huge opportunity to make a major dent in our daily usage of water here, our actual consumptive use. So, yeah, we've got our work cut out for you. A lot of it's cultural, to make changes in our lifestyle behaviors that will produce a smaller water footprint. You know, I was playing with your model the other night, and I thought it would make me feel a whole lot more comfortable, Mike, if we add another small tier to this sort of hierarchy of use, being the conveyance water at the bottom of the cup, and then after that the critical human needs, and then after that, maybe put a food layer in there, that certain types of food that show high efficiency and they're sort of a staple in for living, you know, by people, that would also be a layer considered for at some more reduced price than what would be available dollar-wise in a high security or general security area. That way it establishes its priority position on beneficial uses, it's on the water need, and at the same time creates more stability on its price to be available more often than not for growing, say, wheat or alfalfa or whatever, you know, the ag people choose as the most important food products.
But it's interesting you talk then about beneficial use, which is really a requirement that water be used. We in Australia have scrapped that now, and people are allowed to stockpile water and not use it if they don't want to. They just actually miss out on the income opportunity that comes from that. And that once again created the security for people to make savings. At the moment, if you read some of the doctrines that surround law in America, if you don't use water, then in one sense it's not yours because it's not being put to a beneficial purpose. So you don't have a framework which really encourages people to save water and then, having made the saving,
no,
transfer it.
Especially in the prior privative doctrine, we don't. I mean, to keep your water right, you have to continue to use it, demonstrate usage. And if that means just dumping the excess that you didn't really need over the ground and let it evaporate, that's what you do to keep your water right. And that doesn't...
Yeah, well, that's crazy.
It's totally crazy. Yeah. But what I was referring to is just placing more of a critical place food, water for certain types of food in a more stable, secure part of this model, so that we don't have people deciding on growing corn to make ethanol instead of corn for people to eat. You know, those types of things. One of the issues we have here in California that people are very upset about is they recognize that a huge part of our population that has a lot of money is Southern California. They could buy us out if it came to money any time up in Northern California. And Northern California is where the water is coming from. And so if you follow the money, that could actually cause Southern California to buy up so much of the water shares that other areas of the state of California would end up getting hurt. And again, that's why I was thinking from a food perspective, maybe it could be designed to incorporate a little more security for food anyhow.
I'm not convinced that you can stand in the way of progress and that ultimately you can stop a market from really telling you what you've really said. If you have said to everybody that, in fact, lawns are more actually valuable than growing corn, mm-hmm. then ultimately people will find backdoor ways to do it. If the aim is to keep the price of food cheap, then you wouldn't do that by stopping people from having access to water and trading it, because water is incredibly heavy. It's the cheapest thing that you deliver into a house. It's cheaper than sand. If you order some sand to be brought to your house, it'll cost you 20 times what actually the same weight in water will cost to have delivered to your house. And if the aim is to use water policy to shift wealth around the world and support people who are on low incomes, the craziest way to transfer money to those people is to try and distort water prices. It just doesn't make sense. You're much better off if you want to give somebody $100, give them $100 rather than give them 1,000 tons of water and say, now see if you can think of some other way to use it.
So what I'm hearing, you say is really, it really ends up taking some of the robustness out of the system if we create too many tiers in this model.
Yeah, well, you got to be very clear about what you're trying to use each instrument for. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about too much corn being grown for ethanol, then look at the policies that drive the demand for ethanol. And I think in the United States, that's because ethanol is subsidized. So farmers are growing corn for ethanol because the government is prepared to subsidize that process. It doesn't make sense to subsidize the production of corn and then take the water away so that you don't use water to grow corn. You've got all these perverse things going on. It would be much simpler and smarter to get actually energy policy right in the first place rather than have flawed energy and flawed water policies.
Well, that really hits home. We seem to do that with banks and insurance companies too. It's not necessarily the proper way out. Well, this idea I think has a lot of merit in this approach, and you're applying it in Australia, right? And are you also thinking about doing it in the Netherlands? You're working on a project over there right now.
Well, I'm actually writing up some stuff for the Netherlands now, but in the end of August, I'm shifting over to the United States, to Harvard University, to try and write a book on how to do this. And one of the case studies which I'll be looking at very closely while I'm over in Harvard is the systems that you find at the moment in Colorado systems and also in the around California. I'm about to move to America.
Oh, boy. Well, you're going to have some of our apple pie over here once you get here.
Well, I hope so.
You know, so this appointment is the Gull Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser Chair of Australian Studies. That's a pretty prestigious professorship that you're going to be attending. Then this is a year long?
That's right. It's a year long appointment. The Australian government funds one person each year to go and sit in Harvard University and build links between Harvard and Australia. And I've been actually offered and have accepted the chair from August of this year through to the end of May next year. So I'll be over in Boston or Cambridge, mm-hmm. and looking forward to talking a lot more to people like you and perhaps even coming out to some conferences and things in your part of the world, and hopefully spending a lot of time talking to water managers, environmentalists, and irrigators about options for the future and different ways of doing things.
Well, I can turn you towards some people that I think would be it would be very good to have a conversation with here in California and also up in Washington and Montana. Yeah. Mike, Thank you. Thank you for all this time today talking about our favorite subjects, water. And now for me, water, economics, that's a new one. But, you know, it's a management strategy and it actually has an effect on all of our lives. So congratulations on your professorship at Harvard during this next 12 months. And I tell you, you're doing good stuff. So continue doing it. And I'll try to hook with you while you're here in America, certainly if you come out to California.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Nice actually talking to you and stay in touch. And if we can get an opportunity to talk actually further down the track, then let's do that.